Hey there, Battle for Liberty listener. Are you looking to start up a website, maybe a podcast or a blog, or even a website for your business? Well, if so, I've got the deal of a century for you. If you want to start a website, you have to have web hosting. And I think you should get your web hosting through Bluehost. It's the web hosting I use for the podcast here at the Battle for Liberty. Bluehost has some of the best prices you will ever see for web hosting. Just $3.95 a month, but you have to use my special link in order to get that special price. So go over to battleforliberty.com/blue to sign up for your web hosting today. It's easy, it's fast, they're very responsive, and you're going to get a great price. That's battleforliberty.com/blue. The Battle for Liberty, episode 40.
This is the Battle for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Battle for Liberty. Once again, I'm your host, Mike Tilden. Thanks so much for joining me on the podcast dedicated to the journey of the libertarian novice. Don't ever miss an episode of The Battle for Liberty. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, and you'll automatically receive every episode as soon as it's released. It couldn't be easier. All right, we're going to talk about Cuba this week, and that's because it's kind of been in the news. The Trump administration recently leaked information that it would reverse the Obama-era rollbacks in regards to relations with Cuba. This seems to be more of Trump's America First strategy being put into action. But what, if anything, will such a reversal accomplish? See, the state is masterful at achieving unintended consequences, and I'm wondering what will happen when the U.S. re-implements harsh restrictions on the free flow of goods, people, and currency. Will such action actually put America first? Will there be any real benefits for Americans? Or will it simply snuff out the voluntary associations between people living roughly 100 miles from each other? This week, I have the privilege of hosting my friend Meg on the show. See, Meg recently visited Cuba, and thanks to the policies of the state, that's something that most of us just can't say. She's going to share a unique experience with us that you and I aren't likely to have anytime soon. So without further ado, Meg, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
So first and foremost, thank you for being on the show. I think you have a really interesting story to tell about your recent trip to Cuba, which, thanks to government policy, is a very unique thing. Most people can't say that they've been to Cuba or even that they know someone that's been to Cuba. But I'm lucky enough to be your friend, and so we're going to all learn a little bit about Cuba since you got to go there recently. So I guess I want to ask first, why did you decide to travel to Cuba?
Well, I think I was excited that there finally was the lift on the ban. I was just intrigued. It sounded like an exciting place to go. Certainly, you hear about how it's stuck in time, so I had to see it for myself and experience it before it got too commercialized. At least that was my worry prior to going.
Fascinating that you would say stuck in time. I think that's the vision of it that I have. Is that indeed what you found?
It absolutely. So right when we left the airport, we saw all sorts of 1950s cars that were there. And I thought, you know, this is probably just a greeting for the tourists and we're not really going to see them. So I quickly got my camera out because I wanted to get a picture while I could. Well, I was severely mistaken because everywhere you looked, there were cars from the 50s, 60s. Apparently, there were some even from the 40s. Because of that, honestly, that's all there was. There wasn't any other recognizable car brand or car while I was there.
Okay, now, so what is the process for going to Cuba? Is there some special permission that you have to receive either from the U.S. or the Cuban government? I mean, aside from a passport?
Yeah, so it's actually a little more complicated than I had anticipated. Southwest flies there, which is great, and they do help along with the process and make it pretty easy. So on top of your ticket, you also have to have health traveler's insurance, and that's a Cuban requirement that every tourist has that. You also have to have a visa that explains why you're going to go there, and you have to give the dates that you're going to be there. And then when we were actually at the airport, so I flew from BWI down to Fort Lauderdale, I had to state what my reason was for going to Cuba.
And that was a question from the U.S. government on your way
yes.
out?
Yes.
Interesting. So, I mean, what do you do in Cuba? When you got there, what did you do?
Well, we went to an Airbnb. So Airbnb's recently gone in there. And the person I traveled with hasn't really traveled too much outside of a couple islands like Jamaica. So we took a minute for her to recover from her culture shock. and then honestly, we just kind of explored around. It was a little tricky because Google Maps, which I usually rely on when I travel, was not there. I couldn't use it. There was no Wi-Fi, so we weren't able to quickly look up any additional places or anything. Truly, we had to rely on this travel book I brought with me to find places to go and places to eat and what sites to see. So we did a little bit of historical stuff. We did a car ride, and it was like a 1947 Ford, from what the guy told us, that drove us around and took us around Havana and looked at all the sites.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine there's a thriving industry for tourism in Cuba, at least not yet anyways. How did you figure out the logistics of lodging and ground transportation and meals and all that kind of stuff? I mean, were you able to pre-arrange ground transportation?
No, we weren't. There was absolutely nothing like an Uber or car service. I actually had two friends, one's a Canadian citizen, one's an Irish citizen, that had recently been there, so it's a little bit easier for them. So I did pick up some tips and tricks prior to going there. I guess one thing, though, that you know I didn't necessarily anticipate was the money exchange. So U.S. citizens there's a 10% penalty. So I should have, you know, gotten my money out in euro, but I certainly didn't know that. So that was one of the logistical things that we had to figure out along the way when we were there.
So there's a penalty for U.S. dollars, but not for other currencies.
Correct.
Yeah, you can see that's such an amazing example of two states that are in a beef, and you know who always winds up suffering? Well, not the government officials, but citizens like you and me. That's not shocking at all. Okay, tell me a little bit about the condition of the infrastructure. What were the buildings like?
I mean, it was truly mind-blowing. I mean, maybe I was naive going into it, but I did not anticipate that the buildings, every building, would be in such a state. I mean, they were either crumbling or severely decaying. Truly, and Mike, I sent you some pictures. There was no building that looked great besides the Capitol. I would say the majority of them, at least in Havana. So we stayed in the old part of Havana, but we also walked all over the whole city. Most of them looked about three or four stories, and the roof was completely collapsed. So there was no top floor on any of them, but families lived in the lower floor, still under this crumbling building that was completely, again, just decaying in absolute disarray. And it was every single one. And the other piece, if they weren't in these larger houses, there were some apartment buildings that we drove past during our tour. And so you could see the stairs, and that there was no elevator, and they were many, many stories. It was pretty shocking. It was pretty mind-blowing how the conditions were so poor for all the buildings.
That's amazing. Now, how about the roads? So, you know, one of the things we hear all the time, especially those of us that lean towards the anarchist side of the spectrum, we say, well, without the state, who would build the roads? Okay, well, here we have a country that is nothing but state. So how were the roads?
They were not good. So even in these cars that were really old and obviously had to be taken very special care of, they had to go so, so slow in general, but then would have to slow down because of the potholes or there were all sorts of seams. This was sidewalks. This was everything. There were no clean, smooth roads anywhere we went. And like I said, I mean, we did a decent amount of touring around, and it was a bumpy ride.
Wow. All right, let's shift gears just a little bit. What was the propaganda situation like? Were there any wild examples of just blatant communist propaganda that you saw?
I think that was the most shocking for me. Everywhere you looked, Fidel Castro's face was right there. Billboards, posters, in businesses and private homes, absolutely everywhere. And, you know, I've been to China. I never saw anything like this. It was completely, it really blew me away. And they would have things, you know, socialism works or the revolution is invincible, covering the whole country. You know, we left the city, went a little bit further out, and these billboards were absolutely everywhere. On their main sports stadium, it had a large photo of Fidel, and it said something about how he was the ultimate hero for all the athletes. He was such an inspiration for all the athletes. So in pretty much in every facet of life, Fidel was held up as this example and the savior of everyone. And we went through this tour of the government buildings and all of the people, the revolutionaries, were on these multi-story buildings. I mean, these maybe 30-story office buildings. It was just from ground to the top, their faces, and then with like Viva La Fidel written on them.
That's amazing. You sent me the one picture of a large propaganda sign that I can't remember exactly, but I think it said something like socialism works. But the irony is that the sign was hanging on this ramshackled falling down building. It's hilarious to me, but it's also incredibly sad.
Yeah, I think it's especially scary because when you think about it, their Wi-Fi wasn't there. They don't have internet. We didn't see anyone with cell phones. We didn't see anyone with computers. So the only thing they're seeing, and it's really right in their face, are the billboards and the posters that are just covering the country.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like North Korea. For all we hear of what a horrible, terrible regime they have in North Korea, I don't feel like I hear the same thing about Cuba. I feel like Cuba is romanticized and that they're just downtrodden people trying to make it in this world. Did you have the same sense of things before you went?
I agree, and I wholeheartedly admit that I was probably naive. I went into it with an open mind. I didn't have much expectation of what I thought it would be other than interesting. But I would say this time, coming back from Cuba, everyone seems absolutely fascinated that I went there and are absolutely shocked to hear that I found it to be, you know, not this beautiful, pristine country, but rather just crumbling buildings. I mean, it's clearly such a poor country. The people are so poor and really struggling to make ends meet. I mean, we stayed at the Airbnb directly with these people. And even, for example, just a silly little example, but the shower, there was no vent. And so there was just a hole, like this hole at the top of the wall, but it vented out into the rest of the house. And so that's what it was. I mean, it sounds pretty because of all these antique cars, I guess, but going there and seeing the poverty and seeing how they live, I mean, it was truly eye-opening.
That's amazing. Yeah, so you did send me some pictures, and with your permission, I'd like to post those on the show notes page for this episode, which will be battleforliberty.com/40. This is going to be episode 40. So head on over to battleforliberty.com/40 and you'll be able to see some of those pictures. Now was the presence of the state's agents apparent? I mean, were there minders everywhere following you?
Oh my gosh. I feel like every 6 feet or so, there would be either people in the military or a police officer. Now, I couldn't quite tell the distinction between the two. I knew there was two separate sets, but they were jumping in and out of cars. They were all over the sidewalks. They were covering the Capitol area everywhere. And no one there really spoke any English, so I couldn't sort of ask questions, is this common? But whenever we were getting a tour, our driver mentioned to us, he said, it feels like that for 1 million people, there are 1 million police in the country. And it definitely felt like that. Everywhere you looked, they were stationed. And it wasn't even necessarily like, you know, have a couple in the tourist area in case something happens. It was even in far out areas of the city. And just the number was a lot. It was insane how many people there were stationed just throughout.
Did you feel safe, or I rather, did you feel unsafe at any point in time?
I didn't feel necessarily unsafe, but I had concerns twice. I've never had an experience where I was clearly getting, someone was trying to scam me. And so multiple times I had this situation. Once it was right in front of the Capitol, which unfortunately was closed for repairs. I had read that, you know, it was like designed by Tiffany's or something, and it had a Tiffany's chandelier. So I was trying to get in. And then when the guard turned us away, there was a police officer standing right there. But a random guy came up and said, "Let me take you to this other place. It's really great. It's right around the corner." And the guard stared at him and watched, and he didn't do anything. You know, he didn't even sort of warn us. We just sort of let it happen. And then the other situation that made me pretty uncomfortable, we were in a restaurant right in the middle of Old Havana. Again, tons and tons of police and guards around. And there was a very older American man that was very, very angry about how these two prostitutes that he had hired for the night, the one he felt had taken money from him, he was screaming at them. It was really unsettling. But, you know, no one did anything. So the police state didn't necessarily stop the two situations that made me feel very concerned.
Shocking, right?
Extremely.
Let's take a quick break for this message. Hey there, listener. I sure hope you've been enjoying this episode of The Battle for Liberty. If you find value in this program and you want it to continue, I want to ask you to consider supporting the show by becoming a supporting patron. Support from listeners like you is what keeps this show in production. Without my patrons, I wouldn't be able to keep the lights on. You can support the show by donating as little as $1 per month. Any amount is helpful, really. Plus, when you support the show, you gain access to great benefits available only to my patrons, including access to the Battle for Liberty bonus episodes and even free merchandise. I bet you had no idea there were bonus episodes. Well, there are, but you gotta be a patron to earn access to them. So head on over to battleforliberty.com/support right now. That's battleforliberty.com/support. Okay, now, what were the grocery stores like? Are there grocery stores like we think of them, and are they stocked with food, or, you know, is it the image of bare shelves or food lines?
So I did not see any grocery stores, not a single one. And I desperately looked for them because obviously we can't drink the water. So we needed to buy bottled water every single day. The heat, it was sweltering. We definitely were dehydrated, but I couldn't find any. And we walked several of the main squares where one would assume there would be some water. We stayed in the residential area. There were no grocery stores. Now, in one of our tours, someone pointed out what he said was a grocery store. It didn't look like there was anything in there, but again, I didn't go in and explore. But from my understanding, our Airbnb did make breakfast for us one morning, and from what we were told, that it likely took her hours to gather the ingredients, and it was a basic meal of fruit, bread, and eggs.
Wow.
The one store that we did see, they have like liquor stores that also sold pop and ice cream, or there was food kind of people had in like grocery carts and took up and down this main area, this like prepared sandwiches or popcorn, but that was it. No, I didn't see any grocery stores at all.
Fascinating. So what were the people like? I mean, how did they receive you?
I feel like most of them almost seemed a little curious, maybe even excited that we were there. I went with a friend, and, you know, I definitely feel like I probably look American, and so does she. And so a few people did yell after us, "American, American, Miami," and then tried to get across, and sometimes we were able to understand that they had some sort of relative that lived in the Miami area.
That's funny. That's what they, I've heard that from several different cultures where, you know, there's a specific area in the United States or a specific thing, whether it's, you know, a movie or a cartoon character. Like, I've heard that the Japanese love Bart Simpson, and, you know, they'll always yell that at people. And so the Cubans yell Miami, huh?
Yes. It was all Miami.
Yeah. Well, I guess that makes sense. So were you able to get a sense of what the people there believe in terms of the cause of their living condition, or are they just oblivious to the fact that their situation is different than everyone else's?
You know, I truly feel, and I thought about this just because I found the culture just so shocking, that they were just sort of happy and didn't give it any thought. But just seeing them, I mean, they were so hardworking. Life just seems so hard there, just so unnecessarily hard. But for the most part, they really did seem happy, but I don't know how they would know much else.
Yeah, it's good. That speaks to the character of so many different peoples who are oppressed by a regime that's either communist in nature or authoritarian, is that, you know, somehow, whether it's by faith or some other form of spirituality, that they find a way to be happy, in opposition or rather I should say in spite of their conditions. So to me, that's a story about the human condition, but I was just curious as to whether or not they had a feeling that came across, or maybe was it obvious that they couldn't talk about certain things. I mean, like, that is definitely one thing about North Korea, is that it's not just that they can get in trouble for speaking out against the regime, it's that they're so convinced that the regime is actually a positive thing. I was wondering, is Cuba the same way?
So for that, I would say, you know, we went to the Revolutionary Museum, and it was unlike any museum that I was used to. A lot of things were like, Fidel wore glasses like this during such and such event. And there was all sorts of propaganda, you know, this hero storytelling that he came in and saved the day from these horrible oppressors, and he bought the U.S. And just to have this type of museum where it didn't feel historical at all to me, it was almost like a story, like folklore, rather than this factual given education and understanding to it.
Wild. Absolutely wild. Okay, so you've already said that one of the more shocking things was just the overabundance of propaganda that was absolutely everywhere. Is there anything else about Cuba that you would say shocked you to your core? Something that, you know, as an American, we just wouldn't think of before going there?
So something else that kind of surprised me, and again, I had just landed. So we get to the airport, we walk through it. It's not an airport at all, like what we're used to. We get to the baggage claim, and it's absolutely chaotic. There's no signage, there's no numbering. Just stand somewhere, take your guess, and, you know, hope that your luggage is going to come out on one of the two belts, but you don't know which one. It's a total guessing game. Tons and tons of airport workers, I mean, government, they were in, you know, the government sort of uniforms, roaming about, tons of them, but not helping, not able to give any sort of assistance. And then you could clearly pick out the people who, you know, were from Cuba, Cubans returning, because there were all sorts of people with, you know, the airport baggage carts, but they had these off-brand TVs and electronics on them. I would say we saw maybe 10 families that had clearly gone elsewhere. Our flight was coming in from Fort Lauderdale, and I'm assuming that's where they went. But either way, they were traveled outside the country just to get this off-brand, small, not anything like our large TVs. And they then were going through that, like, they had to get on the flight, go through the airport, and get it home. And I mean, I'm making an assumption here, but they certainly seemed a lot wealthier than the average person I saw while I was there. But something as silly or as easy here as buying a new TV, it caused them to leave the country to do that. I mean, that was just wild to me. And, you know, so much effort for something that should be relatively simple, a Sunday afternoon activity, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you can just stroll down to Walmart and get a, you know, 24-inch color TV for like $100. And they, you know, they probably spent a vast portion of savings to
exactly.
fly to another country to get a television. That's
exactly.
amazing. Okay, yeah. So in total, how long were you there?
So we arrived Saturday probably at noon, and then left Tuesday late afternoon. So, you know, almost 3 days.
And overall impressions, are you glad you went?
I'm glad I went. And I feel like a lot of people are talking about going, since, like I said, Southwest flies there. but I've certainly been giving warnings that I don't think everyone would be glad they went, because it isn't like a simple, easy tourist trip. It definitely is a lot more work using the map. There were, I don't know if I mentioned this, but there were no street signs really. I maybe saw a handful of street signs in the whole city. So it just took so much effort to get from point A to point B to figure out where you wanted to go and what you wanted to see.
Amazing. Now that you're back, there's a whole nother side to this. And that is what you were kind of telling me before, is talking to people after having come back. What's the most surprising thing about talking with Americans about this trip since you've been back?
So definitely how the buildings aren't that nice. Everyone thinks it's beautiful, but also the food. I think everyone has this image that Cuban food is like Cuban American food, but we had pretty not good or odd meals while we were there. So finally we were told, and then I researched it to find out if it was true. There were like 80% of these restaurants are all state owned. So it's pretty controlled about the goods that they have and what they can serve and things like that. So yeah, the food was really not good, but the one restaurant that we did find that eventually, you know, was pretty edible. I since came back and looked it up, and it only opened up in later the second half of 2016. So, certainly the food for the whole country is not what people would expect it to be.
That's fascinating. I guess the big question, do you think you'll go back?
No. I guess when I went there, I thought, oh, I need to get here before it's commercialized. But honestly, after having been there, I don't see how it can make any significant changes 10, 20 years. I mean, even the infrastructure to have tourists go there, it needs to be built out so much. I mean, not only the actual buildings, but even things like exchanging the money. So I mentioned there was a 10% penalty. So you could exchange money at the airport, and then you could also exchange money at hotels, but it's not clearly marked, or it's not really defined what hotels you can go to. And in fact, we went to one hotel, you know, the higher end hotels, we went to one hotel, exchanged money one day. And then the next day we went back at a similar time and they were out of money. So it's little things like that that I feel like just make it a pretty difficult trip, because you really do have to be careful with your money, because not only does it have to get exchanged, but it's difficult to find where can you exchange it, and it may or may not be there. And then, so, you know, kind of similar to that, when we were there, half of the city lost water. Not that it was bad water, not that, you know, it was a weird color. There was no water at all. So we were in a nicer restaurant, and it was, you know, even one of my travel books, it's one of the top restaurants in this nicer for Cuba area. And I went to use the ladies' room, and I tried to turn on the water, and absolutely nothing came out. And they were just having this terrible water shortage or something. And then when we went to the hotel hours later, in order to exchange money, there were Americans, and their Airbnb was one of the affected that had absolutely no water. So they weren't able to shower in this 90 plus degree heat, wash their hands, or do anything. And they were frantically trying to find a hotel, since obviously staying at that Airbnb wasn't going to be an option for them for more than another night or so.
I mean, honestly, I'm still shocked that Airbnb is even allowed.
So am I, but from my understanding, prior to Airbnb and prior to the U.S. sort of loosening the restrictions, they call them casa particulares. And so they have this culture sort of where people do run out a room or two. They said that people that had previously traveled there before the ban was lifted had said that there was like a restriction, so you really could, there weren't really that many rooms that were available, but I think that is kind of growing. But yeah, Airbnb is there, and you know, that was great for us so that we could pay them up front rather than worrying about carrying all that extra cash.
Fascinating. So it does appear that at least a little bit of positivity may have come out of the loosening of the restrictions with relations between Cuba and the U.S. Would you say that's a fair assessment? Certainly not that it's going to fix all of their problems, because their problems stem from much, much worse roots. But Do you think it's fair to say that there might be at least some very slow positive changes from the loosening of the restrictions?
I definitely do. You can see, I mean, even the new pop-up restaurant that we saw, and we really liked, clearly there's something happening there, but it's just such a poor country that it's going to take so long for any real impact to be realized.
Yeah. All right. So now there was one other funny story that I think I saw that you texted me about, about the water trucks.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So let's end with this, cause this is really funny and it's a perfect example of how bad government is.
So, you know, we're on our tour and we see this huge, huge water truck, and there is just chaos with all these people, every container and bucket imaginable getting filled up with water. Families, like these little kids, are just lugging around buckets, containers, all trying to get water for their families. So once the chaos dies down and the truck starts to drive away, I looked and I realized that it's leaking horribly. I mean, water's just pouring out the back of it. And it's like this precious thing all these people were working so hard to get, and now it's just pouring out the back onto the street.
I mean, isn't that just the perfect analogy for government? All these people working so hard to get something and the government just squanders it away.
Honestly.
I think that's Cuba. All right. Well, I think we're going to end it there. Meg, thank you so much for being on the show. Like I said, I'm gonna get some of those pictures from you and post them to the show notes page, which is battleforliberty.com/40. And Meg, you can almost guarantee that the next time you visit a third world dictatorship, that you're gonna be back here on the Battle for Liberty.
Sounds perfect. Thanks, Mike.
Okay, thanks so much. Bye-bye. All right, what a fascinating interview. In my opinion, Meg's experience is really important. I think it's essential that everyone understand what it's really like in Cuba, since Cuba is the textbook example of what happens when the state goes unchecked for too long. And of course, the main takeaway from this episode has to be that countries which implement completely socialized systems will inevitably turn out just like Cuba, and that the enthusiastic emancipation of the free market is the best way to ensure that that never happens. Hopefully this point is crystal clear. But there is another point hiding in the shadows here. And that's the point I want to touch on for just a brief moment before we finish up. That point is, how does the US government respond to a regime like Cuba? For decades, the US implemented strict restrictions on Cuba, including trade embargoes, travel bans, etc. It was only recently under the Obama administration that any of those policies started to be rolled back. Maybe the only good thing that I could point to in Barack Obama's administration. And what I'm hoping is coming to the forefront here is that since the Obama administration lifted some of those restrictions, both the Cuban people and the American people have been the chief beneficiaries. Now, thinking back to Meg's story, I can't help but imagine how much worse the struggling tourism industry in Cuba might be without the comparative flood of tourists that have begun to flock there since the Obama administration eased those restrictions. In just months, the Cuban people are now benefiting from the ability to provide goods and services to an entirely new population of customers. See, the traditional idea of the U.S. embargo is that in order to punish a ruthless dictatorship like the Castros, we simply don't allow them to be rewarded with our business. But this line of thinking is flawed in a couple different ways. First, our embargo doesn't actually punish the dictator or the state of Cuba. No, they maintain their lush and lavish lifestyle regardless of what we do. They haven't actually been starved like we hoped they might be. In fact, the embargoes and the travel bans just punish the people who actually conduct free trade in the first place, namely U.S. and Cuban citizens. Such restrictions only serve to reduce the amount of options available to someone looking for customers or suppliers. And when supply of anything is artificially restricted, what happens? Well, the price usually rises. And we're doing this to people who are already astronomically poor, and yet we start to intervene in their market and their prices rise even more, making a bad situation even worse. But what's worse than that, even if there could be something worse than that, is what I see anytime I see a flag-salutin', small-government-supportin' Merkin stand up and defend the embargoes and the travel restrictions. See, they almost always fail to realize that, in actuality, they are supporting a massive government that spends millions of dollars and employs thousands of bureaucrats just to interpret, investigate, and enforce such draconian rules. So, as budding libertarians, I think it's our job to remember that if the end goal is more freedom and less government, that any time someone begins a question with, well, shouldn't the government, the answer is always a resounding no. Just cut them off. As soon as you hear someone say, yeah, but shouldn't we? No. No, that's it. No, we shouldn't. That's how we get to more freedom and less government. As always, check out the website at battleforliberty.com. There you'll find information about connecting with the show on Twitter and Facebook, and how to submit questions for topics for this show. You'll also find our show notes pages, which outline all of the links and references that we talk about for every single episode. For this episode, that show notes page is battleforliberty.com/40. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, and please refer your friends. Please help me to continue growing the show. Finally, please send a positive review on either iTunes or Stitcher. Let's get some 5-star ratings on the books. That will really help me out. Keep spreading the word about the battle for liberty, and until next time, battle on.